Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
Welcome to Crap of the Week.
Sweet, merciful crap!
That was the biggest load of crap I've ever heard!
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 368 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast, Crap of the Week. This is a semi-recurring segment of the Really Awful Movies Podcast, typically wherein Jeff and I would bounce movies that we've watched off one another and get an impromptu, off-the-cuff reaction. So he would share what he sees. And I would in kind, but given that Jeff is on a temporary sabbatical, I thought I'd just do this one solo and sort of do a quick skimming over of what I've been engaged with over the past week and a half or so as COVID counts ratchet up and my viewing habits do accordingly, especially when it comes to stuff streaming on Prime particularly and Tubi, where I'm finding a lot of really quirky and unique horror films of all stripes. It's amazing the free streaming services that are available out there and how the paid ones like Netflix kind of pale in comparison, which is really weird. That's the way it is in Canada, where people try and have end arounds where they get an IP address, a dummy IP address from the States, so they can subscribe to American Netflix. I don't know if this is still a thing, but there's the Canadian one is very, very lacking, and I don't know what things are like stateside, but they predominantly seem to add a bunch of TV shows, like, I don't know, Emily in Paris and Virgin River and all these sorts of like romantic comedy type shows, or running the gamut from these to these kinds of trashy reality shows like Selling Sunset. I've actually watched a couple episodes of each of those. I'm not just pulling these things out of a hat, but they're just the exemplars of kind of the badness that embodies what Netflix is all about these days. Selling Sunset is particularly egregious with a bunch of Beverly Hills real estate agents. It's just a kind of lifestyle porn vanity project involving the real estate agent, and it just goes around and showcases like 10 to 15, 20 million dollar homes in the Hollywood Hills and the kind of trashy denizens of this real estate agency. And it's just, it beggars belief that anyone would hire these people after this program has been on television. But maybe they've since moved on from that line of work now that they're getting paid. I don't know what kind of arrangement they have. Maybe there's some sort of agents emeriti who don't have an actual salary and just have sort of an honorary title. I've been turning to the likes of Canopy with a K and Hoopla and all these other types of things, even some straight up YouTube things when I'm not actually just paying for a new crop of films, whether it's like Possessor or Halloween Kills or some of the newer horror efforts that I've tried to keep up with. But this week I thought I would dive into some Canadiana. And particularly a film from 1988, which was a really good year for horror that included the likes of Slime City and I believe Return of the Living Dead and stuff. 1988, I believe, saw Pin being released too. Had a lot of stellar work there. And 87 was, of course, a really amazing year with Nightmare on Elm Street, Dream Warriors coming out that year. So this was really a time rife for really creative and really amazing horror. I think Brain Damage came out at around this time as well, if not a year or two. If I'm not mistaken, it would have been 1988. But and speaking of brains, I mean, I'm covering The Brain from 1988, a tax shelter Canadian horror film that marries elements of sci-fi and a creature feature that I really, really dug, and I thought it had a really, really good and funny and very endearing quality to it. I think it would be best suited to viewers who find kinship with people who really like The Video Dead and that kind of thing, let's say Reanimator, because there's some crossover there, because David Gale plays a mad scientist in this film, and he's also the chief antagonist to Dr. West in Reanimator, and he plays Dr. Hill in Reanimator. So David Gale, you'll know his face is very, very square-jawed, very, very, memorable. He cuts a very memorable figure from the Reanimator film, and of course in this one too. And it's of particular interest to those of us in Canada, because if you live in the Greater Toronto Area or the GTA, there's a lot of filming locations that you can recognize. I believe the Psychological Research Institute, or PRI, was actually filmed at a Xerox office building out in the west of Toronto in a suburban bedroom commuter community called Mississauga. So, which has about 500,000 people and is just immediately west of us. And the building is pretty iconic. And I thought it was really awesome. And the setup for this movie is one for the ages, too, because you have this nefarious doctor. And, of course, the Mary Shelley Frankenstein illusions continue to trickle down whenever you have a kind of a mad scientist movie. But this doctor is also the host of Independent Thinkers, a show on television which is growing and growing and growing. And he's the host of it, and he's kind of this Tony Robbins-styled self-help guru. If you want to be insulting, it'd be in the similar vein of Jordan Peterson, but more on the lines of maybe a Dr. Phil, I would think. And he has this show that's increasing in popularity, and he praises the viewers and the increasing viewing audience of Independent Thinkers. And I can't think how a show that's ostensibly geared to independent thinkers would, I don't want to be cynical here, have too great an audience, honestly. Because we've seen the kind of audience really intelligent shows draw, and that you can see in the U.S. on PBS or public television, and it's a smattering of what you would get from, let's say, The Bachelorette or some dreck like that. There's also a kid named James Majokowski, and he's a juvenile delinquent, incorrigible youth, even though he's got a hairline that belies his supposed age. But he looks probably about 28 or something. He looks like a grad student, but he's a youngster who's getting himself into all kinds of trouble, including putting sodium bombs in the toilet at his school and using, super glue to affix people to their chairs. All kinds of trouble he's getting up to, and boy, are his parents concerned. And when they reach their limit, I guess, and overarching concern that James should not be able to get into the university of his choice because of his laddish, stupid, and juvenile behavior, they decide to take matters into their hands and register or volunteer young James for some experiments run by this nefarious doctor. And so this Dr. Blakely is the character, and he runs this incredibly furtive, secretive, of course, what else would it be, lab in this, Xerox location in west of Toronto. And this is a super modern, well, modern for the time building, probably modern architecture built in the late 70s, envisioning of what a future would have been, very Jetson style. And he's got this tentacled creature that's sort of a cerebellum-shaped ball of just a gray matter and synapses, and that's being electrified in a lab. And this is like a giant brain. I think they allude to the fact that it's some sort of alien. And this creature is being hooked up to electrodes because, of course, you've got a lab and you got to do this. And it's connected via some sort of satellite dish mechanism. And Dr. Blakely wants to control minds not just through his Independent Thinker show, but by actually sending the brainwaves of this creature out into the general public in order to... I mean, this has a kind of a Invasion of the Body Snatchers kind of vibe to it. I don't know if there's anything with which you can really compare it, but soon... Again, when James finds himself in the charge of this evil Dr. Blakely, James actually gets diodes attached to his temples, and he is affixed to this brain-like alien creature, and finds himself soon hallucinating all these crazy tentacled visions when he's out in the general world. And this includes a pretty funny scene at his girlfriend's place of work, which is some sort of chicken joint, chicken shack, and he sees these octopus tentacles all over the place, and these proboscis, and he's just jumping on the counter and terrified. Soon, however, a bunch of murders become attributed to him, including the sawing of a man in half by a chainsaw. And soon the Toronto's finest, or I guess this would have been just outside Toronto, the attending officers are in hot pursuit of James. For the rest of the film, he has to try and put an end to this nefarious experiment. And this stuff is really glorious. It's actually very, very smart, very, very sharp, has a lot of witticisms. The poster itself, Mind Over Matter, is a brilliant tagline. And there's a scene where this brain imbibes or ingests a victim. And the Dr. Blakely quips, "That's food for thought." I thought this is wonderful stuff. Again, if you're a fan of brain damage, if you're a fan of From Beyond and the Brian Usna films, or any kind of mad scientist sci-fi film, you'll really get a kick out of this very cheap and cheerful film. Again, a tax shelter film from the 80s, toward the latter half of, I think, the time when the government was funding such vehicles. I think before it ran afoul of taxpayers, and people were starting to question why stuff that was really considered by many people, not us of course, but by many people to be like basement level dreck, would continue to be sustained by taxpayer funded dollars. So this would have been late 80s. I don't know, I think the Canadian tax shelter system would have petered out, if not maybe in the early 90s. But this is just a wonderful, wonderful, cheeky, cheerful, super fun film with some really quality kills and some very spirited practical effects, because of course they had no budget. This thing is minimal budget. It's being funded by the taxpayers, of course, and it's just super fun. I mean, it's almost in the same vein as like a Rock and Roll Nightmare, like a fellow tax shelter type movie. And if you're into these kinds of quirky films, whether it's A Slime City or whether it's Brain Damage or one of these, you will really, really get a thrill out of this one. Now, the other film I saw, we're going to the other coast now. It's A Dark Night of the Scarecrow. And this one I'd always seen the poster of. Sorry for dangling my participles there. Jeff would not be happy with that as a grammar teacher. It's a film that's always been on my radar because of the very iconic poster with the pitchfork being thrust toward the viewer, and a scarecrow which almost has a Town That Dreaded Sundown, like Sackhead Jason kind of look to him. And this one has Charles Durning, who's as the main antagonist, and you'll know him. I mean, you'll definitely know him. He's a very sweaty, sort of stocky. He's built like Newman from Seinfeld, which is kind of fun, as he actually plays an evil postal worker in this movie. But you'll know him from The Sting with Paul Newman, but he's been in Dog Day Afternoon, tons of other things. Like, you'll just know him when you see him. He's just one of these iconic actors. And Dark Knight of the Scarecrow is actually a made-for-TV movie, and I didn't know this going in, and I just found it and started watching it because I didn't want to prejudice myself against having any sort of preconceptions about anything to do with this film. But I mean, it has to be, I guess, up there in the echelons of quality horror made-for-TV films, if not in people's top five. Now, I mean, we've previously podcasted the likes of Snow Beast, but I mean, made-for-TV horror was of varying quality, but it was a common thing in the 70s and 80s. And you would throw in Spielberg's Duel as one of these, and it was a TV series, so you can't really throw that one into the mix. But I'd say 1-2, this is one of the better, if not the best, made-for-TV horror film I've ever seen. It's It's an adaptation by Frank DeFelitta, a book. He's the author of Audrey Rose, and this one is all set in the remote South, and this is like down in Southern California, but in the sticks. And it does veer in occasionally into exploitation territory, but for the most part not. And you have this simpleton, kind of a Forrest Gumpian, and he actually is named Bubba, but that's a tie into Forrest Gump. But he's named Bubba, and he's got he's slow witted, an of mice and men type guy, and you see him in the opening shot of this bucolic landscape with the mountains and the farms. You see him playing with a little girl, and I think handing one another daisies. So obviously he's a very good-natured sort, but the townsfolk, the local yokels, certainly don't see him as such. So what ends up happening is the Charles Durning character, points out to his fellow residents that this guy, that he thinks this guy, absent any evidence, is a real threat to kids, maybe as like a child molester or a murderer or someone who's someone they should have their eyes on. And when this young girl gets mauled by a local canine in a backyard, Bubba actually grabs her and saves her from the rampaging dog. But this is used as an excuse by the local yokels to actually go and hunt down Bubba and kill him. So we have the scene where they get sniffer dogs and they hop in the back of a pickup truck. I mean, speaking of, you know, torches and pitchforks, really. And Bubba is on the run, and he's got a kindly old mother who dresses him up as a scarecrow and tries to hide him in the field. Now, obviously, the bloodhounds are on his tail, and he can't escape the rampaging vigilante mob. You know, as the Simpsons said, what is it? There's no justice like angry mob justice. The foursome, led by this postal worker Charles Durning character, they pump a bunch of lead into this poor guy, and he's done for. Now, they actually take a pitchfork and put it in the dead man's hands. What is it, dead man? Like, what is it, Jesse James? Who was it? Or was it Billy the Kid? The dead man's hand is that. I think that's Aces and Eights, or is it Jacks and Eights? I forget what it is. The dead man's hand is actually a poker hand. But yeah, they put a pitchfork into the dead man's hands and try and stage a self-defense, which is ludicrous because there's four of them and one slow-witted gentleman. And anyway, this flies in the kangaroo court, and the judge absolves them of any responsibility, and they're able to walk free. Now, the mother of the deceased warns that justice will be meted out one way or the other. And the gentlemen are seen shortly knocking back some pints in their local watering hole and seemingly getting absconding, getting away with things scot-free. That is manifestly not the case in Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, because this is actually a revenge from beyond the grave flick. And it's a bit like that horror flick from the early 90s called Pledge Night, where one of the university pledges comes back from the dead and exacts revenge. But I can't think of another revenge-type film of this ilk from beyond the grave. It's not really one of my favorite sub-genres of horror. But soon, the foursome start to encounter some issues. Namely, one to two of their ranks starts to see this mysterious scarecrow creature appearing in the field. And it's very, very impactfully done. Very, very creepy. Very, very well done, with a lot of thought and care. And I think I read somewhere that this actually jump-started the Jeepers Creepers style scarecrow film. So this one came out in, I believe, early 1980s. I want to say it's 81, but it could be 80. And these guys go talk to the Charles Durning character, Otis, and they say, like, listen, in our farmer's fields, this creature keeps appearing. And he says, like, listen, guys, we can't be meeting up like this, because we're gonna appear guilty in the eyes of the townsfolk, as if we're getting together to sort of corroborate. And we don't want to be. We should maybe steer clear of one another until things sort of die down. Even though I think most of the town supports their vindication in this pathetic courthouse ruling, but Anyway, soon their worst fears become realized when one member of their ranks, who's drunkenly going wandering around the loft of a barn, he falls and falls into a wood chipper to his death. And a bunch of maladies and calamities begin to befall the members of these the ranks of these vigilante murderers, and they think it's the mother of the deceased who's pulling the strings, or maybe she's in cahoots with the prosecutor who's trying to put them away. So anyway, more of this stuff starts happening, and another member of their ranks finds himself buried in a silo by grain, and it was really, really well done. This is a movie that uses like chiaroscuro type shadow techniques. The darks are dark, just the way I like them, just the way horror used to be shot before they started lighting scenes as if they were like red carpet galas or something. Like, darks are great because, as Toby Hooper showed us in The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, another Hicksploitation film, that when you have something dark, your eyes sort of fill in the gestalt, and it adds a lot to your horror and your imagination. And when you see like a very, very brightly lit night scene, it just takes me out of things. I think a lot of people as well, when you have that silvery glow and it looks like basically they shone floodlights on things. And that's not the way night looks. And when I see night looking like night, it warms my heart, right? So as did Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. This was a fabulous film. That takes a while to get going, but once it does, it has a nice slow burn, and the denouement is really, really solid. For all the adaptations of Stephen King, this feels the most Stephen King, even though this is not a King adaptation. I think he would really love it, and although I was unable to find him quoted on it. Maybe he remarked on it in Danse Macabre, in that book, which I have to actually rebuy because the cover fell off mine. I read it so much, but this is King-like in a way. So if you really dig Stephen King, you'll like this because it's definitely in the spirit of his types of films, even though the locale is nothing anything he would really position his novels around, given that they're always in the Northeast, in New England and stuff. This is a different kind of setting, but it still really, really works. Has a very creepy, rustic Children of the Corn type vibe, and they make amazing use of pitchfork tines, of course. The performances are really, really good. Charles Durning is fantastic. You got one of his cohorts is Robert Lyons as well, who you'll definitely know from Death Wish and Murphy's Law and stuff, and fans of genre film will really, really like the portrayal of the dim-witted, mentally challenged Bubba character, Larry Drake, of course, of the film Darkman, which Jeff and I podcasted and which I really, really dug, and he's an almost unmistakable figure. Yeah, but the performances across the board are really good. It takes a while to get going, but doesn't waste your time either, because it's a fairly, fairly tight, taut production, and it has a lot of distinctly spooky and engaging elements. I really, really like the Scarecrow. I thought it was really, really understated and really well done, and the characters are really, really believable and really solid. And it's possible, yes, they could have done a little more due diligence with their forensics team to realize that the mauling was actually done by a dog, which should be pretty obvious to see if you're an attending physician, that it was not the work of a human, but rather a man's best friend. So that was kind of silly. The legacy of this film lives on, and a lot of critics have lauded it, and rightly so. Anyway, that's what I've checked out this week. I am trying to sort of implore myself and really commit myself to just sticking with what I decide to watch. It really is an embarrassment of riches when you have so many streaming services, because I pay for Shudder, Stars, Amazon Prime, Netflix, and all these things, but then I also have a bunch of free ones I avail myself of. And whether it's your Tubis or the ones that are linked to the local library system here in Canada, which is Hoopla, and there's just an unlimited variety of things, and it's amazing. Like back when I would have been perusing the aisles of your local video store, hunting down movies, I would have spent probably an hour just thumbing through the stacks and trying to find something that is really impactful. And I do vaguely recall something like The Brain being a film I would have encountered around that time. Is it something for sure that would have been populating the VHS bins of my youth and that? But it's funny, like that was so much more satisfying an experience than it is to just scroll through thumbnails, because even if you got something that was just total and utter dreck, you felt like your $2 to $3 was invested in so much insofar that you had to follow it through, whereas there's nothing invested. And when nothing is invested, something is disposable, right? So for a Tubi film, who gives a crap? You're in 5 minutes, you have nothing invested, you can just bail and bounce. But if you really persevere, you're going to be rewarded. And I think Dark Knight of the Scarecrow will do just that. And similarly, The Brain will just do just that. I have to catch up on a bunch of horrors, and it's going to take me a little bit of time. I got so much on my my watch list that it's been hard to make a dent in it. But I've really, now that we're in the post-Christmas time, I had to sort of curtail my Christmas-related viewing, I'm going to have to probably save a bunch of those for the upcoming year. And I'm going to be diving into some more films. I just noticed that a bunch of iconic Seagal films are moving over to Prime and Netflix. So I'm going to be covering the likes of Under Siege. I'm just a cook. I just can't wait for that one. My God, that's just going to be so good. The Navy Man, Casey Ryback, one of these just iconic, ridiculous character names. It's funny, not to go on a tangent here as we draw the show to an end, but Steven Seagal, he's got such a boring name. He sounds like a certified general accountant, like Steve Seagal, and he always has these ridiculous Gino Fellino, Casey Ryback, and Elijah Kane, and all these just two and single syllable badass action movie type names. He's just, it looks like he's trying to compensate for something. But anyway, looking forward to a bunch of those things, as well as doing some deep dives into the Shaw Brothers catalog, but also doing some Chuck Norris work as well, as we put the finishing touches on promoting our Mine's Bigger Than Yours, 100 Wackiest Action Movies book. And we're just waiting on hearing from the publisher whether we can possibly pursue a sequel to that, which I'm really, really hoping for, because I'm really also diving into some 90s flicks. But I'll keep our listeners abreast of those as developments continue, and we continue to bring you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, and action films of today and yesterday. Enjoy the holiday season, or the hangover thereof, and we shall talk to you soon. Take care. Thank you.